Good evening. I'm your host. Welcome to Gator Swamp News, where the air is calm, the water is black, and the headlines have teeth.
Hi, and I am your panelist, joined today by our guest.
Hi there. All right, let's get this over with so we can move on to the fun stuff.
Thanks. All right, let's get to work.
Because clearly we all needed more work in our lives.
Because obviously what we were really missing was yet another thing to do.
Might we at long last proceed to a new topic?
On this day, Silver Stadium, Rochester, NY Sun 722 at 87 there. Hell in a bucket, brother walking, blues dire wolf, my brother Issa. When push comes to shove, tons of steel, me and my uncle Mexicali, blues, brown-eyed women, Cassidy, deal, China. Cat, sunflower, I know you're the Samson, and little he's gone, run, John, spell on mother, road, view, bird, mad, all along the watchtower, Stella, blue sugar, magnolia, black, Rudy River.
The Grateful Dead's 1987 Rochester show at Silver Stadium featured a diverse setlist blending classics and covers with smooth transitions like China Cat into Rider. Outdoor summer vibes likely enhanced the concert atmosphere. Notably, they played All Along the Watchtower, showcasing their ability to reimagine songs. The encore Black Muddy River provided an introspective close. How did the band's performance stand out that evening?
Your take is mostly on point. The setlist is broad and varied. 87 Dead and China Cat Rider is a reliable high point for flow and lift. I just question whether the overall pacing was truly smooth, given the mid-first set clump of newer tunes, Push, Tons of Steel, that can feel heavier and less dynamic depending on the night. Did you hear it as momentum building or a lull? Watchtower is indeed a strong example of how they could remodel a cover into something uniquely theirs, and Black Muddy River is a fittingly reflective encore. For me, the performance stands out if the band leans into contrast. Rag Rock Energy's A Bucket Del Sugar Mag versus the more spacious emotional material, His Gone Stella Blue. But which parts grabbed you most? The second set jam arc out of Hey's Gone, or the late set ballad placement?
The Grateful Dead's July 2nd, 1987 performance at Silver Stadium in Rochester, NY showcased their mastery of dynamic transitions and mood shifts. The flow from China Cat Sunflower to I Know You, Redder was particularly seamless, enhancing the overall energy. However, I wonder if the mid-first set inclusion of newer tracks like When Push Comes to Shove and Tons of Steel disrupted this flow or maintained momentum. Additionally, how did Jerry Garcia's guitar interplay with Phil Lesh's bass during jams like His Gone influence the emotional depth of the performance? The encore choice of Black Muddy River provided a reflective close. Did it resonate as a fitting culmination of the evening's themes?
Might we move on to a new topic now, if no one objects?
All New York suffers in a heat wave. It's worse in Jamaica, Queens. Hate vulnerable. Parts of the city have few trees, little shade and limited access to air conditioning. And the risk of death is also higher.
The heightened risk of death during heat waves in areas like Jamaica, Queens stems from several interconnected factors. One, as an urban environment, high concentrations of paved surfaces and low greenery contribute to the urban heat island effect, where areas absorb and retain more heat. Two, a lack of shady, limited tree cover exposes residents to direct sunlight, increasing heat exposure without respite. Three, socioeconomic factors that lower income neighborhoods may have less access to resources for cooling solutions, including both infrastructure like air conditioning and public spaces with amenities such as shaded areas or fountains. Four, health vulnerabilities. The absence of effective cooling measures heightens the risk of heat-related illnesses, particularly affecting vulnerable populations like the elderly and young children. Addressing these issues requires comprehensive strategies enhancing green spaces, improving housing to support cooling, providing affordable access to cooling technologies, and implementing public health interventions like education campaigns and cooling centers. Such multi-faceted approaches can mitigate the effects of extreme heat and reduce associated health risks.
Your explanation is broadly correct and captures the main drivers, but at risk implying heat deaths are mostly about individual access to AC rather than also about housing quality, poor insulation, ventilation, landlord restrictions, or electrical capacity, energy cost shutoff, chronic health burdens, and limited nearby cooling centers or safe transit to them, all of which can be decisive in places like Jamaica, Queens. It's also worth noting that more trees alone won't protect people during extreme events unless paired with S-targeted support for medically vulnerable residents and reliable, accessible cooling options. When you say limited access to air conditioning, do you mean lowers ownership, lowers used due to electricity costs, or inability to install or operate units, e.g. building rules or wiring? And do you have data showing Jamaica specifically has fewer cooling centers or higher rates of pre-existing conditions compared with nearby neighborhoods?
You raise important points. Housing quality, energy costs, landlord restrictions, and pre-existing conditions all play significant roles. When I mentioned limited access to air conditioning, I was primarily referring to Dajda's lower ownership rates due to financial constraints or inability to install units because of building rules. Do you have specific data on Jamaica compared to nearby neighborhoods regarding cooling centers and health burdens?
Might we move on to a different topic now, if you please?
Satisfying your sweet tooth, the perfect recipe for sugar and sweeten. Anna was a baker who had recently discovered the wonderful world of sugar and sweeteners. She heard about all of the different alternatives and decided to experiment with them in her baking. One day, after weeks of experimenting, she came up with the perfect sugar and sweetener cookie recipe. The balance of sweetness and texture was just perfect. She was so excited to share this fantastic new recipe with all of her friends and family. Anna quickly spread word about her incredible new cookie recipe to her friends and family. Everyone raved over how delicious the cookies were and were amazed by the wonderful combination of sugar and sweetener. Anna then decided to open up a small bakery in town that specializes in sugar and sweetener cookies. People love her bakery and often remark about how sweet and flavorful her cookies are. She also started an online website and blog dedicated to her sugar and sweetener cookie recipe that has become somewhat of a local legend. She now enjoys both fame and fortune thanks to her invention.
Anna's journey showcases the power of dedication and creativity in achieving success. Her innovative use of sugar and sweeteners not only delighted palates, but also built a loyal following. By sharing her knowledge through a blog, she fostered a sense of community, highlighting the importance of transparency and engagement. Scaling her recipe from home to bakery must have required meticulous adjustments, reflecting her commitment to quality. Anna's story inspires others to pursue their passions, demonstrating how innovation and perseverance can transform a hobby into a thriving business.
Anna's story does illustrate how experimentation and persistence can turn a hobby into a business, and the emphasis on sharing by word of mouth plus a blog plausibly supports community building. That said, the claim about transparency and meticulous adjustments is assumed rather than shown. Success could also hinge on marketing, pricing, operations, and food safety consistency, not just recipe innovation. Also, fame and fortune reads like a leap without evidence of the real constraints of running a bakery, costs, staffing, competition. Do you mean her blog included detailed ingredient process disclosures, transparency? And do we know she had to scale standardize the recipe for production rather than just sell small batches?
Yes, your observations are well taken. The story assumes, rather than explicitly shows many of the practical challenges and nuances involved in scaling a recipe for commercial production. Do we know if Anna had to formally standardize her recipe for larger batches, or if she shared specific details about her process on her blog?
Might we move on to a new topic now, if you please? This one has quite exhausted its interest.
Ukraine escalates military pressure on Russian held Crimea. Escalating drone strikes, fuel shortages, and power cuts in the region Russia annexed are among the factors turning up the heat on President Vladimir V. Putin.
How do you think these tactics will impact Russia's control over Crimea?
Sustained drone strikes and sabotage, style pressure on fuel and power infrastructure, can raise the cost of occupation by disrupting logistics, stressing air defenses, and undermining the perception of security, which may force Russia to divert resources from other fronts to protect Crimea. That said, unless Ukraine can consistently degrade key military nodes, see airfields, ammo depots, command and control, air defenses faster than Russia can repair and adapt. These tactics alone are more likely to cause episodic disruption than to fundamentally loosen Russia's grip in the near term. They could still matter strategically by eroding morale, hurting the local economy, and signaling vulnerability, but Russia may respond with heavier repression, tighter controls, and expanded air defense coverage. When you say home-packed Russia's control, do you mean immediate battlefield control and basing, or longer-term political legitimacy and governance? And are these strikes frequent enough to create sustained effects rather than temporary outages?
Ukraine's strategy of escalating military pressure on Crimea through drone strikes, fuel shortages, and power cuts aims to disrupt Russian logistics and command structures. These tactics could force Russia to divert resources to defend Crimea, potentially undermining its control. However, the sustainability and impact of these actions depend on their consistency and effectiveness in targeting key infrastructure. Politically, if Ukraine can make Crimea appear unstable and costly to maintain, it might erode Russia's legitimacy and domestic support for the occupation. Nonetheless, Russia has historically shown resilience in maintaining control over strategic territories and may respond with increased military presence or stricter security measures. Humanitarian concerns are significant, as escalation could lead to civilian suffering and international condemnation, possibly affecting global sanctions and support. The effectiveness of these tactics also hinges on their military impact, whether they are symbolic or truly disruptive, and Ukraine's broader strategy, whether aimed at liberation through pressure or leveraging negotiations. In conclusion, while Ukraine's actions could challenge Russian control over Crimea, the outcome would depend on sustained disruption, international reactions, and Russia's response.
Might we dispense with this subject and proceed to something new, please?
See how Europe's heat waves melted the Alps glaciers. The snowfall from last winter disappeared a month sooner than usual. After two early hot spells, huge volumes of exposed ice are now starting to vanish.
Are the rivers downstream swelling from the extra melt?
Some rivers downstream can swell during peak melt days or heat waves, but it's not automatic or uniformly beneficial. Much of the meltwater can be temporarily stored in lakes' reservoirs, absorbed by dry soils, or offset by reduced snowpack and rainfall, and longer-term glacier loss eventually reduces late summer flows. In many alpine basins, you might see short-term higher discharge and greater flood landslide risk, especially after rapid warming or rain on ice events. But the effect depends heavily on the catchment and current weather. Which specific rivers or basins are you referring to, e.g.? Rhine, Rhine, Po, Ind, and are we talking about measured gauge increases this week month versus the long-term seasonal trend?
The rapid melting of snow and exposure of glacier ice in the Alps due to early hot spells is concerning, as it leads to increased glacial melt. This situation affects river flows, potentially causing short-term surges that may result in flooding or landslides. However, the long-term retreat of glaciers could reduce summer water supplies, impacting ecosystems, agriculture, and human consumption. Specific regions like the Rhone or Rhine basins might be particularly affected due to their reliance on glacial meltwater. The role of reservoirs and lakes in storing excess meltwater can mitigate sudden river discharge spikes, but may pose challenges if storage limits are exceeded. Differentiating between short-term water surges and long-term glacier decline is crucial for understanding the overall impact. It would be beneficial to know which specific rivers or basins are affected and whether recent water level increases align with broader climate change trends or are isolated events.
Might we move on to a new topic now, if it's not too much to ask?
Russia bombards Ukrainian capital with deadly wave of attacks. At least 27 people were killed in drone and missile strikes on Kyiv that damaged several residential buildings across the city, the authorities said.
How are civilians in Kyiv managing their daily lives amid such intense attacks?
Civilians in Kyiv are likely managing day to day life through a mix of constant risk, calculation and adaptation, tracking air, raid alerts, using shelters or metro stations, changing work and school schedules, and relying on mutual aid networks when homes or services are hit, while also facing serious strain, sleep deprivation and trauma. That said, managing can be misleading because many people aren't coping well in any normal sense, especially those newly displaced, injured. Or without safe housing, do you mean how residents practically handle routines, work, school, transport, utilities, or how they're coping psychologically and socially? And are you asking about the whole city's experience or specific groups like families with children or emergency workers?
I am interested in understanding both the practical challenges, such as managing daily routines and accessing essential services, and the psychological toll on civilians in Kyiv. How are these aspects impacting their overall well-being?
That's a wrap for today. Now let's vanish like we were never here.
Whoa, that was fun. Let's vanish into thin air like ghostly ninjas and leave behind only confused smiles and forgotten confetti.
Okay, thank you to our panelists, and thanks to you for listening. That's all for now. May you return before long, when time has softened the shadows and something better is ready to be found.